Welcome, everyone, to episode number 78 of Underserved. With me today is Adam Firestone, Chief Engineering Officer at SciLogic. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Thank you, Adam, for joining us today on Underserved.
Hi, Andrew. It is wonderful to be here. I am very grateful for having the opportunity, and thank you.
You're very welcome. So once upon a time, you thought the greatest thing was a portable tape recorder. Why? How does that get you interested in tech?
So I grew up in Brooklyn about a billion years ago, and the neighborhood I grew up in was very working class and middle class, and folks there, they didn't throw things away. They fixed everything. And the other thing they did was, if they could visualize an idea about how to make their lives better, they built it themselves. And so today, for example, we take things like programmable thermostats for granted. You know? And so you would see guys sit there and they'd hang out with each other and they would have a bunch of components on the kitchen table. And after about 2 hours, someone would have a bright idea. They'd all go upstairs and they would put together a programmable thermostat that was entirely mechanical, and it worked. And I grew up around that. You know, I grew up around guys who fixed their own cars because it was economically feasible to do that. And so there was this culture of, I see what I want. I can visualize how it will make things better. And these are the resources I have at hand, and I can do that. Okay. And there was always this, how can I make it better? This culture of tinkering. And so the greatest thing in the world for me as a kid was, wow, I don't have to listen to the LP. I don't have to listen to the vinyl. And by the way, for those of you who are listening, if you know what vinyl is, much love. But I want to listen to my music when I want to listen to my music. And I started to say, well, I've got a tape recorder and I've got a few spare jack cables and some alligator clips and the stereo. I could just pull apart the speaker. And there's a lead in, right? The Tron's got to go in somehow. And these alligator clips will tap into that. And lo and behold, I can make my own mixtapes. Really, to me, what that was a continuation of the, how can I make it better with what's on hand for me? And that's where I got started in technology. It was very much a self-created kind of thing. And because that's what I knew people to do. You know, I never knew it as I was going to get stuff from the outside. It was going to do it for me.
I like that DIY hacker ethic. What was your first computer?
My first computer, I borrowed a friend's Mac something way back when in the 80s. And I wrote a paper on it. I wrote all my papers in college longhand on legal pads. And then I would take those and edit them and scribble on them and do all sorts of other things. And then I would type them up on an electric typewriter. That was high tech in my world. And the use of a word processor kind of blew me away. This makes my life better. This is awesome. And so when I got out of college and after I got out of the Army, I went and I spent some of the not terribly large amount of funds that I had access to on a no-name brand 286 computer that I bought from an outfit in Manhattan where they had to hold it for the first 24 hours to do a burn-in for you. And it had an EGA, Echo Golf Alpha, EGA monitor on it. And it had a huge, amazingly high-capacity 20-megabyte hard drive.
Ooh, that's a piece of equipment.
Yeah.
So rewind a second. What was your service in the military like?
I was a cavalry officer. And so for the first part of that, I was a tanker. And that was cool. But tanks are what tanks are. Although I will tell you a story about a tank. After I got out of the full-time Army and I went to my first National Guard unit, I want to describe what an M60A3 tank turret looks like. It's a lozenge-shaped, if you looked at it from the side, contraption. And if you pop yourself down inside, the entire front of the turret is all business. It's about, you know, that's where the gun is, the gunner sits, the loader sits, the coaxial machine gun sits. And if you turn around and you face the rear, to your right is ammunition stowage. That is ready ammunition that can be popped out and tossed into the gun tube. To the left is where all the radios were. But in the center, there's this big open space. And it was called the oddment tray. And you could put all the stuff that you, your personal gear and things like that in there. Now, the M60A3 was a development of the M60A1, which is development of the M60, which is development of the M48, blah, blah, blah. All those previous tanks to fight at night used a searchlight, which meant they had an alternator the size of Guam. They never took those alternators out when they got rid of the searchlights and replaced them with thermal sights. So you've got this alternator capable of putting out a whole bunch of power. And soldiers are brilliant when it comes to making do. And I pop myself down into this turret. I turn to the rear. I am an impressionable young officer. And sitting there, wired into the alternator, is a microwave oven. You know, I'm like, wow. And then I was also told, hey, you know those boxes on the side that hold reload smoke grenades? Yeah. You know they're thermally insulated, right? Yeah. You know the smoke grenade's roughly the size of a 12-ounce can, right? So there may have been times when ice and cans of cold beverages. It was amazing. Make do with what you have and expand on its capabilities to do what you want. Now, I stopped being a tanker because I mentioned cavalry. Ground cavalry units had both tanks and what they were called scouts or scout platoons. The scout was a reconnaissance organization, and they were, if anything, probably the most creative bunch of soldiers in the military. Exceptions being, you know, special operations forces and those folks done a different plane. But cavalry scouts, very, very smart. Their basic task list dwarfs the rest of the combat arms. One of the things I recall was when you're doing reconnaissance, one of the things you need to be able to do as a leader is you've got to do three things. You've got to fight the vehicle. You've got to conduct the reconnaissance. You've got to continually be in communication, explaining what you're seeing and when you're seeing it and what significance you think it might have. And that provides the eyes and the ears for the commander to make a decision. So there you are, your young lieutenant, your vehicle's bump, 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 bouncing off the terrain, and you've got one hand on the spade grip of your 50 caliber machine gun. You got one hand holding down the map on the top of the vehicle and trying to focus on where you are. You've got one hand holding the radio handset to your head. And if you just counted, that was three hands, right?
Yes, sir.
And I said to myself, at that point, there's got to be another way. It's got to be a better way than fighting the way we fought in the 1950s, 1960s, and 1940s. And so that contributed to this sort of like, how can I make this better sort of outlook that I grew up with? I'm a recovering attorney, and when I worked in a law firm, they had a number of offices, and none of those offices were connected. Everything was on paper, and if you needed to work with someone across town, that meant faxing things or going there, and that just didn't work. And you sat there and you made a few phone calls, and in order to have a data line, it was horrendously expensive, and the phone company was going to take forever to do it. And again, back to the early internet days and the concepts of email sort of emerging for general public use, there's got to be a way to do this better. So I decide that being a lawyer was not for me. And I left New York City, and I moved to Virginia, and I go to this job fair. And it's mobbed. And they've got all these tables with these beautiful displays. I mean, people spend a lot of time and money on them and demonstrations. And then there's one table. This one table has got a whiteboard on it with some hastily scribbled acronyms in handwriting that is even worse than mine. And they look lonely. And so I said, I'll go talk to these guys. And the net of that was I spent nearly 20 years at SAIC. And I learned a tremendous amount and I was given tremendous opportunities. And I became the most overused job title in the Washington, D.C. metro area, which is systems engineer. Now, systems engineering, there's actually a MIL standard on it. There's actually an ISO standard on systems engineering. So we can define what systems engineering is. But systems engineering in the government contractor community means, oh, you look like you might be useful, but I don't know what to call you. I know. Let's call you a systems engineer. So everyone and their mother were a systems engineer. And I was fortunate enough to work with a few people who were just brilliant people and mentors and who to whom I'm really eternally grateful. And what I learned about systems engineering was that it's the ability to see the whole thing and at the same time describe the way to get there from the components you have on hand, what you might need to acquire, what you might need to buy, build, or otherwise create. And that put a framework to what I'd lived with for most of my entire life. And I had the opportunity to work on a number of really interesting projects, ranging from national senior leadership decision support systems to humanitarian demining. And the last thing I had the opportunity to do was really make an impact on the modernization of a major naval power projection weapon system. My part was really, how do we take this from the best 1970s technology money can buy, or at least the best 1970s technology paradigms money can buy, and bring it into the 21st century? And by the time I left SAIC, I was not only, I would say, a good systems engineer, I was teaching systems engineering and sort of bringing along more junior engineers.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
What did you learn about security while you were there? What was your kind of view at that time?
So it's really interesting. The contractor world was really in flux. At the time when we were doing our stuff, security was SEP, right? Those guys over there, the information assurance folks, were going to take care of security. You had to do what you had to do. Contractual obligation was neatly boxed, and they were going to then do their thing. And if you had to change stuff based on what they had to say, you'd grumble and you'd change stuff based on what they had to say. But it was a throw it over the wall kind of relationship. And that ran afoul of what I thought of as systems engineering, because systems engineering, if you're doing it right, is holistic. And there is no security in engineering. What there is there's either good and complete engineering, or you've left something out. And it doesn't matter what you've left out. If you've left out a critical component, you've got an incomplete system. And if you've got an incomplete system, how do you field that? You can't. And then you go back and the rework is expensive and time consuming. You don't want to do that. So at the time, it was really sort of this weird, almost like the relationship with test. Do your thing, be developed in terms of software by someone else. You would be busy writing test stuff that would go to someone else. They would throw it over the wall. And it was sort of like the archetype written about by Gene Kim in the Phoenix Project, the way it should not have been. And I was very gratified, by the way, when I started learning about DevOps later in my career. I said, oh, wow, yeah, that's good engineering because everyone's talking to one another. That's the way it should be.
So I have a few questions about WSO2. I guess my first one is, what does that stand for?
It doesn't. There are many things that it could mean, but it was the brainchild of two frighteningly brilliant men, Sanjeev Arora and Paul Fremantle. And they were working in service-oriented architecture and web services sort of at the beginning. And they said, you know, there's a better way to do this, and we could be a breath of fresh air in the web services industry. So WS is web services, O2 is oxygen. It's the breath of fresh air, and it doesn't really stand for anything as an acronym.
So you wanted to go build things there, but sometimes that means you're building a tiny piece of someone else's big picture. What was that like?
Let me say this. I have nothing but love and respect for everything and everyone at WSO2. Brilliant people doing great work, building excellent products, and their business model was innovative and creative and effective, and they knew how to run with the tech and finance landscape really, really, really well. And they knew how to harvest things in terms of exploiting the benefits of globalization. So let's start with that. I mean, WSO2, big thumbs up. For me, I wanted to solve things. I wanted to build stuff. That was the vision, right? I grew up kid in Brooklyn. I have this problem. What do I need to do to solve it holistically, right? Everything. So that at the end of the day, someone who doesn't know anything about the way I solved it can just go and do the technology goes boink thing from, I think, Calvin and Hobbes and make it work. At WSO2 was middleware. However, I met some folks at WSO2 who really created or nurtured my views on security and built-in security and security as part of the overall solution. You know, like imagine a human body without an immune system. Well, you can't because it's just part and parcel of the overall whole. Really, they built some products that were dedicated security products, but when they built their products, security mechanisms were always built in from the ground up. And that was the big aha moment for me, courtesy of WSO2.
I think you said in the pre-call that a lot of people think of like guards, gates, and guns, or like build a fence around it and then you're all set. But this is a different approach where you're really kind of architecting in the security from the ground up.
I don't know that it's different. I think that people who call themselves security professionals would tell you, yes, that's the way it should be. The problem is it's hard to build an industry around that. And so what we wind up doing is building security mechanisms for two reasons, right? Number one, that's what sells, and you can't blame someone for making an honest buck. And number two, we humans are hardwired for what we can see, sense, and feel. And when we look at the world, security means a fence. It means a gate. It means things we can taste, smell, touch, hear, see, and doesn't necessarily mean things that are just there that you never know about that make your life better, like the BASF formula, right? Think about a car in 2022 versus a car in 1972. is not even comparable. They look like the same thing. But at the end of the day, what they really are two vastly different machines, one of which has tremendous amount of safety mechanisms built in, one of which gets you from point A to point B and will generally keep you alive through some rudimentary mechanisms, but don't count on it. The firearms industry, if you look at what happened starting in the early 90s and the inbuilding of safety mechanisms into various types of firearms, from a technological perspective, it was a huge game changer. It shifted the ground. And I think we are starting to become aware of that in the technology industry and starting to build it in now. And you're seeing that. I mean, iterations of operating systems get better and better and better and more inherently secure without stepping on a user.
I think a lot of businesses are in the business of having to do security, even when it's not their main thrust of their business. We talked about like Ford or Levi's.
Right. You know, everyone's got a SOC. Everyone's got high-priced security professionals. And that's just the way it is. I mean, you can't do that for many reasons, right? You can't not have that stuff. You need that stuff because it's expected. Because organizations and entities and individuals that you're going to work with expect you to have it. And if you don't, it's looked at as irresponsible, not following through or not having everything in place that you should have in place. And then there's the fact that there is something to be said for defense in depth and layered security. It's not a bad concept. It's not an irrelevant concept, but it is a concept that evolves from physical guards, gates, and guns, and it is one that is inherently undermined by all our technology, which today relies on connectivity to be effective, which means I've got to have a hole in my wall somewhere, many somewheres possibly, and now how do I control that? In order for my organization to be effective, information's got to flow in, got to flow out. And if it doesn't, well, I'm probably in a place just as bad as if I had no security.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features.
To deploy the release, deliver first. You must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
I wonder if this will remain a standalone thing. As a callback to a previous Underserved episode, John Arsenault talks about there used to be a vice president of electricity for companies because each company had to come up with its own electrical plant to provide themselves electricity. And now, of course, electricity is ubiquitous. We all have plugs. We just plug into it. It's a utility. I think that security is probably going to stay its own standalone discipline, not get absorbed.
So maybe yes, maybe no. I mean, I spent some time doing standalone security, threat intelligence specifically, because I forget, what is security? What is the internet? Can I buy it in a box? You know, and it's a really hard thing to wrap your head around before there's a general understanding of what the internet is. Security kind of is a paradigm, and we think of it in a given way. But I think we're on the cusp of starting to realize that security, like beauty, comes from the inside out. I'm almost being facetious, not quite. So my current role with Cylogic was created out of a conversation with a buddy who's an attorney, and that buddy says to me, they have no associates, they have no staff, they have many hundreds of partners scattered all over the country, and the thing that keeps them sort of organized together is this one cloud-based system. And I'm like, oh, well, that's kind of interesting. And he says, yeah, but nobody likes it. And I said, what do you mean nobody likes it? And he says, you know, it's expensive. People have to learn how to use it. It takes their work away from them. They feel that they don't own their work product. And the firm hates it because they feel like there's a lot of overhead and they're constantly helping people overcome technical issues. And so I'm sitting there talking to probably the second smartest person I know. First smartest person I know is my father. And we said, you know, they got other problems, right? Number one, law firm, right? The most important information any one entity, person, organization has, hand it over to this third party because they're going to help you with it. Well, now that information, you have to trust that they're going to manage that information securely. And when they're putting this information and information derived from that information into this cloud-based system, you're under now the assumption that the people who manage that cloud-based system and the administrator for the law firm are trustworthy. And oh, by the way, if people can see your stuff, they can change your stuff. Think about an oil drilling lease, right? I change a number in the lat long, you know, a little bit here and a little bit there. And all of a sudden, your multi-billion dollar energy drilling or energy exploration lease is now worthless because you're now 70 miles away. And that's a real thing, right? We have seen cases of we're going to disadvantage organizations because we disagree with their politics. And if you're trusting someone else to keep your stuff together, they can turn you off. And you have no stuff to keep together. And what does that do to you? We had an inkling of that. I think it was 2017. There was a glitch at AWS. And command line administrator working a command line interface enters the wrong character inadvertently. And AWS US East goes down for 6 hours in the middle of the day. Now, by the way, they took all the right steps after that. So big thumbs up for AWS. But you got a taste of what being separated from your information looks like. Imagine that happening deliberately. And you probably could sue somebody and you'd probably win. But by the time you won, you don't have a company anymore. So, wow, we've got confidentiality, integrity, and availability issues out the wazoo. And so we sat down and over time, we put together an idea. And this idea encompassed the use of industry standard cryptography in innovative ways and decentralization and new ways of networking and new ways of using networking. And the idea that just like the immune system or just like those internal safeties in your car, the safety mechanisms in your car that you never see that keep you safe and alive and comfortable and warm, you would just do your job. You, the user, do your job. And at the same time, there is that those gaps that apply within the security world are being closed and you don't even know about it. And what that does is it takes security from this abstract, somebody else is doing it for me, to a, I'm going to start securing at the elemental level. And what's our elemental level? It's the information we produce. And the information we produce is the value that our organizations run on. So we're going to start securing that as soon as it's created automatically with no user interaction. All the user is going to know is they can work the way they've always worked. And oh, by the way, if we're smart about this, we're going to make it easier for users to work collaboratively across the hall and across the world. And if we're really smart about it, we're going to throw in some other stuff that makes organizations happy, the ability to never lose control of their information. And all of this came together in terms of the project that I run and the organization I have the privilege to work with today. The idea is the big remaining gap area in security is user and the value, the creativity that the user brings to the table. We don't pay people large amounts of money just to mash buttons. We pay people to mash buttons and take what's between their ears and translate it into value that we can store and use and exploit and make money with. And so if we can secure that, and then we can do it in a way that works collaboratively and close those last mile gaps, we make a big difference and we change the landscape a little bit.
It sounds interesting. It's more of an idea of like encryption at inception and then also having that check mark that everyone asks about on every security questionnaire. Is it encrypted at rest? Yes. In fact, it was encrypted since it was created and it will be till the end of time. And you mentioned not losing control over that. I'm imagining that if it goes outside the enterprise, it's basically useless.
I'll give you an analogy. You own a bakery, and every day at 3 o'clock, you lay out your tray of chocolate chip cookies, and they're the best chocolate chip cookies in the world, okay? And every day at 3 o'clock and 22 seconds, an enterprising and really, really, really agile 8-year-old kid runs through the legs of the patrons lining up to get your chocolate chip cookies, grabs a handful in each hand, runs out laughing and giggling until you can't hear him because his mouth's full of your chocolate chip cookies. And he's giggling all the way down the block. He's going to come back every single day and he's going to keep doing that to you. And you can't close your doors because you keep your patrons out and you sort of accept this loss of your chocolate chip cookies or some portion of them as the cost of doing business. So let me change the calculus. What if comes in, grabs your chocolate chip cookies, which automatically reproduce, so they're not actually lost. And when he shoves those chocolate chip cookies in his mouth, they turn to ashes. He's not coming back. You have now eliminated the ROI for his stealing your chocolate chip cookies. And so the other part of the things that we've come to an understanding about security is that security is a business. And well, you know what the other side is? The attack is also a business. And if you can affect the economic underpinning of the attack, guess what? People are going to stop doing it. It's like the Benzie box thing in the 80s and 90s. So once upon a time, motor vehicles had their radio, their stereo in one place, and it was really easy. If you get into that car, within a minute, maybe a little more, you could grab that radio and you were gone. And radio theft was big, big, big business. And so the interim thing that the automobile industry did was they came up with this idea of all those wires that go into your radio, we're going to put them into a standard mail connector at the back of your dashboard. And then we're going to wrap your radio in a sheet steel box, and all the wires coming out of your radio, we're going to put them into a female connector at the end of the box. And so when you're in the car, slide the box into the gap in your dashboard, and it looks like your radio, and you're fine, and you can do your thing. When you leave the car, take it with you. Now, what we've done today in terms of automotive engineering is your radio is not in any one place on the car. And so there's nothing to steal. And so you know what happened to the industry that was built on stealing automobile radios? Gone. History. Because there's no value to it. We're seeing it again happen with catalytic converters. The theft of catalytic converters is a huge business. Well, you know who doesn't get hit? Motor vehicle manufacturers of higher end cars where the cat is up inside the engine compartment and really difficult to get to unless you have the car on a lift. And that's what I meant about holistic engineering. So the security on cats in a lot of cars today was never a concept when they built the car. What's happening now is that's becoming more of a front and center thing. And you're building that security in. And you're thinking about it before you build the car.
So you're attacking the hacker economics and what used to be, I like the acronym you had, the BFJT, Big Fat Juicy Target. Ooh, let's go after this server. It has all this valuable stuff on it. Now, if they pull it away, it's like the kid eating the cookie that turns into ash.
From our perspective, it's more than that, right? A big, fat, juicy target is just that. Think of, instead of a server, think of a swarm of drones or a swarm of insects or a swarm of birds. The individual entity stops being so important as long as the collective, which makes up the greater whole, is still operable. And a bad actor, a threat actor, has to go and go after every component of the swarm. And that's tiring and that's expensive and that's hard. The concept, the BFJT concept that you brought up, is less about crypto. And it's really more about the idea of how do I decentralize information management and provision. We are just starting to scratch the surface of effective enterprise-grade decentralization technologies.
You're also an adjunct professor at Georgetown and George Mason?
I was an adjunct professor at Georgetown for a long time. The program I worked in went away, but I had the privilege of teaching systems engineering and cryptography at Georgetown. At Mason, I taught undergraduate cybersecurity engineering. I also teach seminars. And in fact, just the week before last, I taught a seminar on quantum computing and its impact on the rest of us, so to speak. So I mentioned the smartest person I know and have ever known is my dad. The second smartest person is a good friend and a brilliant engineer who I happen to work with. And we talk about education all the time because my education was very non-traditional for an engineer. The benefit of that was that my viewpoint on things is very, very broad. And I can pull in things from a large number of perspectives because of that type of education. And one of the things I was discussing recently with another friend was this notion of Landauer's limit. And Landauer's limit is a thought experiment that says, hey, based on the power consumption of classical computing devices, think your PC, your phone, whatever, and the amount of power that they use, even in an optimized ideal state, and the amount of power that the planet can produce by 2044, if we don't change something, we are literally going to be unable to produce enough power for the planet because of the amount of computing devices on the planet, which is kind of terrifying. I said, you know, one of the things we don't talk about, folks don't get ordinarily excited about or not aware of, is the fact that quantum is as much about quantum material science, which allows us to start thinking about super efficient materials. And the reason you can sort of bring those things together is you've got to have this really broad view of the universe. And how do you get that? Well, on the one hand, I deeply believe that STEM education is a national security issue. I mean, to the point where if there was a program to cover part of someone's education, if they major in and or graduate from with a STEM major, regardless of what they do with it, I would think that is a good thing. It would be an investment in the ultimate public good. The flip side of that is the way we do STEM education, especially at the university and above level, is it's laser focused, exclusionarily focused. I mean, Bachelor of Science degree programs are really, you know, what is it, 126 credits, and you are focused, 100 of them are on science and math or engineering. The problem with that is that you wind up being the person who's in their 30s or 40s saying, oh my gosh, no, I can't carry on this conversation because I never heard of that book, or I never heard of that concept, or I never heard of that part of history. And the other part of that is, without that breadth of understanding, that broad liberal arts education, to understand where the new STEM concepts fit in. And if you think about the fact that, for example, quantum is this marriage of Bohr and Heisenberg and a bunch of other guys, brought their brilliance not just from a technical perspective or a math perspective or a physics perspective, but from the rest of their education to bear on these problems, you start to see that education, you also need to temper that and couch it in an understanding of the world around you. And so this concept of a broad liberal arts core curriculum provides that breadth of imagination that allows us to conceive of solutions to the next hard problems.
I'm going to have to try and talk my middle daughter into that. She's very STEM focused.
You know, reading is so important, and we don't push it anymore. And it can start with fiction, and then you start broadening it out to include a little bit of history, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And then you start thinking about, how do I apply all these things to a holistic solution? And even if you're not building the holistic solution as a 22-year-old college graduate, you're thinking about it, and you're bringing that with you. And the more we start thinking about holistic solutions, the more we realize we have to work together and cooperatively and collaboratively, and the less we start Xing people out of our universe, which I think is a good thing.
Speaking of fiction, I believe you're a Robert Heinlein fan.
I am. So I rarely read fiction these days, but I will tell you, I've read most of Heinlein, and I give Heinlein as gifts. Stranger in a Strange Land, Starship Troopers, Time Enough for Love, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. It should be core curriculum reading, as far as I'm concerned, in most schools, or at least in most families.
I'm a big Philip K. Dick fan. A lot of his stuff has been made into a zillion movies.
I heart Philip K. Dick. You know, I joke with folks that I self-medicate with military sci-fi. So,
what else do you do for fun when you're not hands on keyboard?
For a long time, I was doing a lot of cooking. And that was a big deal, because cooking is like engineering. And to understand cooking really, really well, you have to be more than just a saute expert. You got to understand flavors, and you got to understand spices, and you got to understand how they all come together. So cooking was a lot of fun. I travel a lot these days. I travel a lot for work. And one of the benefits is I get to go to a lot of really cool places. And so it's really important, because it gives me a chance to see and expand my view of the universe, because everyone's got a legit way of living. Just because I don't live that way on a day-to-day basis when I'm in this hemisphere doesn't mean anyone else is wrong.
Heinlein has a famous quote about what a human being should be able to do that kind of wraps up with specialization is for insects. Is that what made you kind of go deep on learning first aid and so on?
So yeah, so that first aid thing, I do. I spend probably 40, 60 hours a year either in instructor-led classes, in online learning for emergency medicine, just because I'm fascinated by it. I am my brother's keeper, probably have some gauze and some hemostatic stuff and some tourniquets and some other things hanging around. And in fact, the most localities have something called a community emergency response team. I'm on my local community emergency response team, and basic trauma first aid is something we're taught. And I think it's a big deal. I grew up in a house with a Renaissance guy, and I would watch him decide, I'm going to be good at Chinese cooking. And boom, like a laser, read, test, cook, read, refine. Boom, he was good at Chinese cooking. I'm going to be good at roller disco. I'm totally serious, by the way. And all of a sudden, there are the cartwheels and the backwards. By the way, I have the grace and poise of a dyslexic water buffalo on crack. Okay, so not me. But oh my gosh, I'm going to be good at this. And I'm going to learn everything about this. And I had that as a mentor. And that was normal growing up. And so, you know, the joke about the Kindle used to be that if you scratched the finish on it, it would show you that it was really The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, because it was everything you could possibly want to know about everything. And that's really true today. We have unlimited access to information. So if you want to know about the Fourth Anglo-Mysore War of 1799, there is no shortage of information for you to become an armchair expert on that in 48 hours, 72 hours, or, you know, however long it takes you to read the four or five books. We are awash in information. It's sort of a golden age in being able to learn anything someone wants to learn.
I totally agree. And YouTube has been my muse there.
No kidding. YouTube is kind of awesome for that, because we all learn differently, right? I learn by reading far more than I'll learn from a video, but other folks need to be visual learners, and YouTube caters and zooms right into that and supports it brilliantly. So I couldn't say enough good things about that sort of thing and those uses. The theme, you know, overall theme from my technical journey and becoming a technical leader, and something I try to inculcate in the junior folks in the organization that I lead now, is it's really, really good to be really, really good at something. But to make that something more valuable and to really take it to the next level, you have to understand that it interacts with many other some things. And the broader the picture you can develop through your own self-improvement, through your own interaction with other parts of the world, with other people, with reading, with different subjects. I mean, again, ranging from cooking to automotive to whatever you're into, the better at your original job you're going to be and the more relevant it's going to be. And so bringing it back to security, security is part of the ability to deliver value to life. And if we forget that it's not just security, and it's not just finance, and it's not just ease of use, and it's not just user experience, but we think holistically, we'll start to deliver beautiful products with exponential benefit instead of linear benefit.
Very cool. So Adam, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Andrew, thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun. I really appreciate it.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved. Until then, so long, and thanks for all the fish.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.